morning. It's good to be back with you and not coming from a hospital. So not very often that I miss a week and it doesn't involve doctors and nurses. We made it to Nebraska to see Missy's family and had a good time. We always go by this place every time we go up there, and I don't know anything about it, so I decided to look it up. And it's the place where these explorers back during when we bought out west and we were exploring out there, they were up on a hill, and to not go so fast in their wagons, they put the brakes on, and the horses or mules, whatever, drug the wagons, and so these ruts are still in the ground from where they drug the wagons all the way down this hill. And that's pretty amazing, but I would really like to talk to those first, I don't know, 25 or 30 that didn't put the brakes on. That I bet that was a wild trip down the hill there. I always find it interesting when we go up there and see those kinds of things. So I'm glad to be back, though. And so we'll pick back up in Colossians. We've made it to chapter 2, and that's where we will start this morning. There's the story told of a man who brushed his teeth twice a day, and the doctor examined him twice a year. He wore boots when it rained and slept with the windows open. He stuck to a strict diet with plenty of fresh fruits and vegetables, and he got at least 8 hours of sleep every night. He never smoked. He never drank. He had a pretty even-keel temper. He exercised every day. He should have lived to be 100. And the funeral's going to be this Wednesday. He was 53 years old, survived by 18 specialists, 4 hospitals, 6 gyms, and a whole bunch of manufacturers of health and health foods and drugs. Again, this person followed all the rules. He imposed the strict regimen. He did everything he was supposed to do to have a long life, and yet he still died. All of the specialists, the hospitals, the gyms, the manufacturers of the health food and drugs, all the rules and regulations that he lived by still couldn't help him attain their goal. He still died. And if you were to listen to all of those health gurus of today, you might be fooled into believing that if you did everything right, you could live almost forever. And yet many of us realize that even if you do, can you not hear me? Turn me up a little bit, Earl. I'm going to try. I won't start all over, but we'll try this again. Again, this person, he still passed away. And again, if you listen to all of those people of our day, you could be fooled into believing that if you did all of those things, you might be able to live forever. But we know that's not true. We know that no matter what you do, we could die at any time. Such behavior might help us live more healthy or more wholesome lives, but there's no guarantee in that either. The church, the Colossian church, was being visited by spiritual gurus who were offering similar assurances. These were false teachers that were guaranteeing that their teachings could make anyone who followed their instructions acceptable to God. And if they dutifully performed these instructions, then they could live forever. And so Paul, he refers to the teachings of these individuals as being hollow and deceptive philosophies, being based upon human tradition and following the principles of the world versus being based on what Christ has said. So what is this false theology? What was being taught by these false teachers that was so threatening to these Christians in Colossae? What was the false theology that Paul regarded as so evil and devious? Well, it was that these false teachers were coming in and they were observing that they weren't following these strict set of rules and regulations that they should be, that they could be assured of being pure and holy and acceptable to God according to them. And on the face of it, that seems to make sense. Everybody has rules, right? Schools have rules. Workplaces have rules. Homes have rules. Even churches have rules. It's part of what makes for an orderly society. When everybody knows what the rules are, it's easier to live and to work together. And in religion, it helps to know where the boundaries are. If I know what to avoid, if I know what sin is, then maybe I won't sin nearly as often. Although that doesn't always work out that way either. One minister stood before his congregation and told them that there was about 700 sins. And that afternoon, he got 46 requests for the list. Everybody wanted to know what they were missing out on, I guess. But knowing the rules, what was even important in the Old Testament, part of the purpose of the Old Testament law, what was so that God's people would know the difference between right and wrong. And so playing upon that truth, these false teachers who had came into town had put together a rule book of what the Christians had to do or didn't had to do to be acceptable to God. And so if we turn over to Colossians 2, beginning in verse 20, that's where Paul says, if with Christ you died to the elemental spirits of the world, why, as if you were still alive to the world, do you submit to regulations? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, referring to things that all perish as they are used according to human precepts and teachings. They have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-made religion and asceticism to the severity to the body, but they are of no value in stopping the indulgence of the flesh. These people had came in and they had this whole list of things that said don't handle, don't taste, don't touch. And the nature of these rules and regulations, that's what we would expect to see from a rule book, right? Don't do this, don't do that. That's what we see. But then we get that phrase there at the end, verse 23. That's an interesting phrase. Paul says, these have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-made religion and asceticism and severity to the body, but they are of no value in stopping the indulgence of the flesh. So what's he saying there? You mean to tell me that if I follow all the rules, if I understand all the do's and don'ts, that's not going to help me restrain my sinful nature? Yeah, that's what it says. So how could that be? That doesn't make any sense, really. But then it really does make sense. If you think about when you're driving down the highway and you see a sign that says 55 miles per hour, what does that mean? And how often do you see other people driving at that rate of speed or less? And if you do happen to see someone driving that rate of speed, what ends up happening? Everybody starts passing them, right? It's like they were passing some little old lady who can barely see over the steering wheel and that they're driving 5 miles an hour. At the earliest opportunity, everybody behind that person going 55 is whipping around them and trying to pass. Why? Do they not know what the speed limit is? Sure they do. It's just that they regard that posted speed is too slow for their needs. Sometimes even police have difficulty keeping the speed limits. I read a story of a group of travelers going down the interstate in Pennsylvania, and they were clipping along at a pretty high rate of speed until they spotted a state policeman coming on the on-ramp behind them. And everybody slowed down. And there had been some road work going on, so there was only one lane of the interstate available, and so nobody was allowed to pass. And after a couple of miles of driving on this slope of Pennsylvania Highway, the state policeman, he activated his bullhorn, and through that, he told the other drivers, I am not a Pennsylvania state policeman. I'm a Connecticut state policeman. Please speed up. Even that policeman had problems obeying the speed limit. It was too limiting at that time. The rule that we should drive 55 or whatever the speed limit is has no power to keep us from breaking the law. If the rule becomes too inconvenient or challenges what we consider to be fair and just, we ignore the law. Or we find a way to bend the rules, or we just simply break it. And we'll always have an excuse or a rationalization as to why we can bend that rule. What rationalization do people give for going 5 or 10 miles over the speed limit? Almost to a T, everyone will tell you, well, there's a 5 or 10 mile per hour grace given by the police. That may be true. That may not be true. But it is still just a rationalization. The problem with depending upon rules to make us moral is this. If I want to keep a rule, I will. If I don't want to keep that rule, I won't. So rules and regulations will only make me as moral as I want to be. No more or no less. So therefore, if I'm going to be more moral than I have been in the past, then I have to want to be more moral than I have been. Something has to change within me to make me want to be different. Jesus would say in Mark chapter 7, beginning in verse 21, that for from within, out of the heart of man come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and they defile a person. I seen a story of a small village in Africa where the water supply was being dug by a well in the middle of town. And one day, the water wasn't so good anymore, and people started getting diseased, and it became stale, and plenty of people got sick, and they couldn't figure out the reason why. And they tried boiling the water, and that didn't work. They cleaned out their hot water boilers, and they boiled the water again, and still people were getting sick. And so specialists from the United Nations came in, and they inspected the well, and they found that the pump had been cracked, and that surface water was seeping into there and contaminating the supply. And so when they installed a new pump, the water was again pure and disease-free. In order for that water to be pure, though, something had to change in the heart of the well. The pump needed to be changed. Then the water became clean. So also in us, something has to change in our hearts, or our deeds will always be tainted. Well, we may be able to set down a set of rules, and every single one of us has a set of rules by which we live by, but those rules will always be warped by our desires. That which we want to do will always color our obedience to the rules. Something has to change inside of us. And well, if we look at chapter 2, beginning in verse 9, Paul says something has changed. He says, for in him being Christ, the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily, and you have been filled in him who is the head of all rule and authority. In him you were also circumcised with a circumcision made without hands by putting off the body of flesh by the circumcision of Christ, having been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith in the powerful working of God who raised him from the dead. Verse 13 says, and you who were still dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made alive together with him, having forgiven us all our trespasses by canceling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. He set aside, nailing it to the cross. He disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame by triumphing over them in him. Something has changed inside of us as Christians. When you and I were baptized into Christ, our sinful past was removed, like dead flesh being cut away from your body. Our hearts were filled with Christ, and you and I, verse 13 tells us that we have been forgiven of all our sins and that we've been made alive in Jesus, In other words, that old sinful heart has been taken out. It's been cut away and replaced with a new Christ-powered or Christ-centered heart. And because of that, now you don't do good things because of rules and regulations. You do good things because Christ dwells within you. You're not moral because you have to be. You're moral because you want to be, but because your heart now belongs to Christ. I read a story of a woman who was married to a tyrant of a husband, and he didn't like the way she kept house. He didn't like the way she did the laundry. He didn't like the way she ironed his clothes or the way that she dressed. He didn't like the way that she acted out in public, and he constantly criticized everything that she did. And early on in the marriage, he handed her a list of 25 rules for her to follow. She hated those rules. She grew to hate him as well. And you can imagine how frustrating it was to have to hear him always constantly check to see on the list if she had been doing what she is supposed to do, and her doing it herself to try to stay out of trouble. But she always utterly failed. And each time, if she was lucky, she would get a tongue lashing from him. He made her feel miserable and small. And then one day, something wonderful happened to her. The abusive husband died, and she soon fell in love with a wonderful, loving man, and they loved each other deeply, and she practically broke her neck to please him, would even at times bring him breakfast in bed. And one day she ran across that old list, and the feelings of anger and inferiority returned, and suddenly she began to laugh. She sort of realized as she looked over that list that she was doing most of these things for her new husband without even realizing it. She did all of these tasks now with joy because there was a common love between them. Well, to kind of finish things up, there's a final story of a man named Ken who was a laborer on the Alaskan pipeline back in the mid-70s. And he worked in the cold for most of the year and would come back to the continental United States with some money, and he would blow that money in about a month. And so he would go back, and he would make a little bit more money, and he would come home again. And this time he decided he was going to visit a church. And that first Sunday, the preacher said when he walked through the door, he had two thoughts. This guy looks like Grizzly Adams, beard and all, and this guy will never become a Christian. And that preacher said, I preached my message and gave an invitation, and the instant that the singing began, this man came rushing down the aisle. He said, I thought he was going to crush me. Tears were coming down his face as he gave his life to Jesus. He said the next Sunday he was back at services and he didn't recognize him. He was dressed in a three-piece suit and no beard. He said, I asked him what caused him to dress up so much, and he said, Jesus changed me on the inside, and I want people to know it. And so I changed on the outside. Again, rules and regulations won't make us moral. They can't make us acceptable to God, but a new heart within us, an overpowering love for Jesus in our lives, then we can joyfully serve God knowing that we've been changed on the inside so that we can be changed on the outside. And so this morning, as we finish up this portion of worship, we extend that invitation. We want you to know Christ as your Lord and Savior. We want you to know that his death on the cross and his resurrection was not for someone far away. It was for someone, for each of us in this room today. And so if you need to make that decision to put Christ on in baptism, we urge you to do that. Or maybe having already done that, you need the prayers in some way of this congregation to be publicly known. Please come as together we stand and we sing.